Judiciary Committee as a policy committee will come to order. Today is February 24, 2015, and we have a wonderful list of bills coming before us today. We're going to start out with Senator Pappas's Senate File 337. Senator Pappas, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very happy to be first on the list today, so thank you. The St. Paul School District brought this bill to me after a meeting with both the city and the school library staff to discuss a really exciting model in Nashville called Limitless Libraries, where the city and the school provide seamless services for students. So this will provide a much more efficient and equitable distribution of library cards across the district. It's a technical change to update the Minnesota Directory Information Law to conform with the last federal update. And we have a specific date listed that we thought the committee would be more comfortable with. So the district shared the information with in-house counsel of other metro districts and it's been reviewed and supported by the public law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. And if there are any questions, Nancy Cameron, who's the general counsel for the St. Paul Public Schools, is here.
Are there any questions for Senator Pappas or for Ms. Cameron? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pappas, thank you for your explanation, but I'm not quite sure how the system works now and what your bill would change. Could someone that you might have at the table be able to tell me what are we really, in practical terms, trying to do?
Good question. I think Ms. Cameron can tell you the nitty-gritty.
Ms. Cameron.
Yes, I can tell that. I can tell it in more detail or less detail, so whichever your preference is.
Less detail unless Senator Limmer wants more.
Okay.
After that.
So under the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, school districts have to obtain a parent's written consent prior to the disclosure of personally identifiable information from a student's records. However, school districts may disclose personally identifiable information that has been designated as directory information without written consent unless the parent has opted out of the disclosure. And they may do this if they've provided certain notice to the parents. What this law does is makes the state law consistent with an amendment to the federal law that took place in 2012. And that law narrowed the definition of directory information under the federal law so that school districts could limit the disclosure of personally identifiable information to specific parties for specific purposes or both. And one of the things that is considered directory information under the federal law is address. And St. Paul Public Schools has treated addresses as private information. But what St. Paul would like to do is to designate addresses, for example, as directory information and make it available to certain parties or for certain purposes. And in the case of the library, we would make the addresses available to the public library, which also treats addresses as private data.
So the practical impact, Senator Limmer, would be students would be issued library cards. And they've already got a plan in work so that the libraries will order materials that are important for students to have when they're doing a research paper or working on a particular project. And they don't have to go down to the library and get the library card themselves. They just will have the card and would be able to use it. Also, with their new iPads, they'll be able to use the library resources the library has available online.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
The testifier made a reference to certain information could be used for specific purposes or parties. And is the way this is written, how narrow is that? Could you tell me what parties or purposes this expanded use of information could be used for?
Ms. Cameron.
So first, this wouldn't be an expanded use of information. It would really, from St. Paul's perspective, it would be more of a narrowing and an expanding at the same time. The way the directory information provision is currently written is under state law, directory information is public, and it's based And the specific reference references a law that is outdated. It's not the current federal law, which allows the limitation to specific parties or for specific purposes. So a specific purpose could be, however the school district defines it, it could be to governmental entities, for example. It could be to governmental entities that treat the data as the district would treat the data. For example, if we treat addresses as private and the library treats it as private, it could be written that way. What's happening now is that some school districts, like St. Paul, are saying addresses are not directory at all, and then they can't be used for any purpose like sharing it with the library. Other districts are using the addresses as directory and making them available. So, and that's allowed. This is all allowed by federal law as to how the district does it, as long as they give notice to the parents in advance of what information is directory. So, and perhaps, I mean, I didn't want to confuse anybody, but the whole purpose of the law of FERPA, and one of the things about the directory information, is to make certain information available that schools can disclose for certain purposes, like student publications, playbills, graduation programs, names of athletes. If a school couldn't disclose the name of the athletes, wouldn't be able to have programs for athletes or programs for graduation without written consent to the parents. So that, to explain that a little more.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer.
In the bill, do we in any way negate or reduce the involvement of a parent affecting the use of their child's information?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the first part of the question.
In this bill, Mr. Chairman, in this bill, do we negate or reduce the involvement of the parent in the use of information regarding their child?
No.
Ms. Cameron.
Okay.
No. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, how is the information obtained, either acceptance or denial of a parent to have their child's name in this directory?
Ms. Cameron.
These names in the directory,
right? To clarify, Senator Goodwin, members of the committee. The directory information is a term of art in federal law, but each school district determines what is directory information. But directory information is considered personally identifiable information that would not be generally considered harmful to disclose. It may consist of something like the student's name, the school they attend, the grade they're in, the extracurricular activities they participate in, honors, things of that nature. And parents find out what is directory information by the notice that the school districts give to the parents annually. And each school district does it different ways. But for example, in St. Paul, name is considered directory, address is not, grade, school. And then if a parent wants to opt out, this is also part of the notice. The parent has a right to opt out, and then they submit that to the school, and they say, I don't want that to be used as directory, and then that would be honored.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Follow
Senator
up.
Goodwin.
Thank you. Just to follow up quickly, I'm concerned about, we have a program in the state that's called Safe at Home, where people can leave an abusive spouse or a stalker or whatever and hide their identity and their children's identity, and we keep trying to improve that to make sure that this person can remain totally anonymous, or their address particularly. So, do the schools do anything to check to make sure that they don't have, that any of those students are particularly protected? Because I'm not sure that a parent would always know that they had to opt out if they didn't want that information to be public at all.
So the Safe at Home program, I'm sorry. The Safe at Home program is a separate program, and that would supersede any opt-out. So if a parent has gone through the Safe at Home program, it's essentially an opt-out as well on the directory information, unless there were something specific that they would say, well, this is okay on. But our intent would not at all be to make addresses readily available. Our intent would be to, for St. Paul, it certainly wouldn't be. But right now, addresses are available in some districts because they've considered it to be directory information. But I think that those districts would as well honor the Safe at Home program, and that's, you know, carefully monitored within the districts.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up. But, you know, I'm really concerned about this because the opt-out issue is my concern right now. So the school districts don't have any way to know who's in the Safe at Home program and who isn't. So even just publishing a child's name without the address is a potential problem for somebody in that program. I'm just really trying to figure out how you make sure that kind of thing doesn't happen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, maybe we need to look at the Safe at Home language to see if in there's some kind of notification to the school district that happens through that route, because I would hate to overreach here and restrict students from getting library cards because we're worried about some Safe at Home students. I'd rather us go directly at if there is a Safe at Home issue, what can we do to protect that child's identity? Because I agree with you. If you just say the child's name and grade in school, that child could be found through doing that. And that's what St. Paul does. And there are other districts that do have addresses as part of their directory information. So I'd suggest that we look at how we can directly protect those children that may be at risk.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Pappas, I've got a few questions, but I sat back here and had a little lunch before, and I was listening. So I want to go over my understanding first is that what we're trying to do is the school and the library is coming together with information to make it easier for kids to get library cards.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas. Hall, basically the schools would issue library cards to all their students.
And they would be good then, Mr. Chair, at every library in St. Paul?
Yes, every library in St. Paul. It's just the St. Paul School District is issuing them.
Yep. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the point of the limit.
Could you please state your name?
Oh, Mary
for the
Gilbert
record?
From the St. Paul Public Schools.
Thank you. Ms. Gilbert.
Right now, when we met with the library, the easiest way to issue library cards would be to share the address information because the kids actually need the barcode to access the library website, which includes homework help, all the periodicals, everything that they would need. And also, we would be sharing resources on the website. And as Senator Pappas and our general counsel said, under the old federal law, if you share directory information, you have to make it available for everybody. Under the 2012 update, you can just share it for a specific purpose with notice to the parent. So actually, we are trying to do exactly what you all have in mind, which is to limit the sharing of information. In this case, it would be address only because we don't share that, and then also because the St. Paul Public Library would treat the information as private as well.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, when you say restrict, you're just saying it makes it harder for kids to get library cards because they could still do it, correct, without this intervention?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, yeah, I assume they could still do it. And they may have one, too. They may have already gotten one at some point in their careers, their lives, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, do you know if use of the library is up with students or is it down over the years? I mean, I think about the Internet and how much it's used now. I wonder if the libraries are used less or if they're used more because of it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, I don't have any statistics at all, but I think because the libraries have evolved to have a lot of their resources online, now that they're kind of up to date. I mean, I have to just tell you privately, I don't buy books anymore. I just borrow them from the library on my iPad.
Yeah.
And sorry for the booksellers, but it's a great you know, it's a great convenience, you know, for me.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hall, the St. Paul Public Library has actually expanded hours in low-income neighborhoods so that families that can't afford to have internet access or access to work site computers and the like have actually expanded the opportunities there so that those families actually do have the resources available for them that they can't afford to have at home.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
Could somebody here give me or find information on the use of libraries around the state and see how it compares city by city or any of that? I'd sure appreciate it. And my last question is, are the libraries and schools, as far as that goes, are they monitored for illegal access like police departments are? If someone goes on searching somebody's name that lives in, say, Burnsville or whatever town, to do that or to get that information, they have to sign on, and then so we have a we know who's been looking up children, say, that, you know, if there were a stalker looking at children, do we have any information from the schools that they monitor that or from the libraries that they monitor who gets on and are checking on kids? Do we have that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hall, we do monitor all of that on the school internet website, and I will have to check with the Library Association, and I will get back to you directly.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions relating to Senate File 337? Seeing none, is there a motion?
I'll move the bill.
Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 337 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Thank you,
Chairman
Senator
and members.
Pappas.
Thank you.
Senator Saxhoff, Senate File 338. Go ahead, Senator Saxhoff.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, today we're presenting, as you said, Senate File 338. This bill will make it clear that the location of the county in which personnel documents are filed is allowed to be shared between government entities. This will ensure the internal database can be used by county veteran service officers to locate the correct county quickly and get a certified copy in the hands of the veterans or their families so that they can access services or benefits. With me today is Kay Rookie from Martin County and Don Kerr from the Department of Military Affairs to give brief presentations and help answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Senator Saxhoff. Ms. Rookie? Welcome,
Senator,
to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Members of the Commission. I'm Kay Rookie. I'm the Martin County Recorder in Fairmont. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. The military discharge paper, which is the DD-214 and other associated documents, the DD-215 too, are recorded at the County Recorder's Office throughout the state. They're generally recorded at the resident of the veteran, or maybe the birth resident of the or the birth county of residency. So they're not necessarily filed there. They could be filed anywhere in the state at any time after the discharge. When working with the veteran service officers and the concerns that they had in locating these DD-214s, we decided that a statewide index using each county's records would be beneficial to locate all of these records. We felt that in the language in Statute 196.08 that it needed some clarification so that we could share these records, their private records, and so upon sharing them, we would be able to have that go from one government entity to another. So we hope that you would support this bill for that purpose.
Ms. Rookie, what is the purpose of filing these discharge records in a county in the first place?
Senator Latz, it's in commission, it's for to get military benefits. They're filed in the recorder's office simply because I guess that's probably the main place, like all the land records are filed there. So it's the most permanent site for military discharge records as our land records.
Okay, so this is the county gives out military benefits? Is that why it's filed there?
Senator, the veteran service officers do the military benefits. We work in conjunction with them, and they have to get those DD-214s through our office. They're recorded and they're filed in our systems for preservation purposes.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I guess, and Mr. Kerr may say something about this, but all 87 counties have veteran service officers, so.
And are they part of the county then? Are they employed by the county?
No. They are financed by the county. Are they, Mr. Kerr? Go ahead.
Mr. Kerr?
Mr. Chair, again, my name for the record, Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of Military Affairs. Yes, Mr. Chair, they are paid for by the county. They're county employees. There's some oversight is not the right word, coordination from the Department of Veterans Affairs at the state level, but they are employees of the counties. The DD-214 is the official record of military service since sometime in the late 40s. There was a previous form that didn't have that number but served the same purpose. And the military determined early that they wanted to make sure that these permanent documents that determined eligibility for veterans' benefits were stored in multiple locations in the event that they became lost. So there are four copies when someone is discharged from service. The main copy goes with the service member. Another one goes to a central repository for each service component. Another copy goes to each county for the home of record that the soldier had when they enlisted in the military. And that's where this can become kind of confusing because often our service members don't come back to the same place that they left from. Many of them are somewhat transitory as they transition. And this is really a bigger issue for family members of older veterans or deceased veterans. Trying to determine which county the record may have been filed in can sometimes be difficult. And basically, they have to call. Because the counties are not currently allowed to share the information between government entities, it means a service member or a representative of the service member has to individually call each of the counties where the record may or may not be to get an answer back. And that delays the process. I think kudos to the Association of Counties because they identified this as an initiative that would really streamline that process. It'll also save a lot of time because each one of those counties that gets contacted would, under the current system, have to then do their own record search to identify whether they did or did not possess that and respond. By having this centralized index, a single county veteran service officer will likely be able to answer the question to say, oh, it's in Sherburne County, we found it. And we won't have to have each of the counties do the search. So I think it will be of a great benefit to our service members and as they become veterans, more so for the veterans. But we periodically have service members who, because of their personal situations, they may be deployed, may be applying for veterans benefits to take advantage of those when they return from deployment, therefore are separated from their own permanent records and need a copy of their DD-214 from a previous deployment to apply for a veteran benefit. This will simplify the process and won't make them contact as many people to try to get those things done.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. And maybe one of you can answer, maybe Senator Saxog. Do these records state whether they had like a medical discharge or a dishonorable discharge, and are they public? Can the public get a hold of that information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, no, they're not public. They do include all that information, and that's one of the changes. And I think it's actually even stated in the law, 2004 perhaps, they were actually accessible to the public. That changed, and now they are not considered to be public information, so that information is protected. You have to have a nexus or a need. You have to demonstrate a need for the information to have the information released to you. But they do include the characterization of service, the length of service, and any special conditions under which the service was performed. For example, service in a combat zone, and what the circumstances were, certain campaign credit and those types of things.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
just
Goodwin.
A quick follow-up. Can an employer get a hold of that information, a potential employer, what kind of discharge it was?
Senator Latz, or Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, no, not unless they had a a release from the service member? I might let you answer that. That might be better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, no, they do not have any availability for that. There's a tangible interest form in which they have to be filled out. They can only be basically given to the veteran themselves or to the VSO, the Veteran Service Officer. So no one else can really receive them. We also always prefer to send all of these records, which are private and in a private database in our offices and not accessible to any other searchers in the office, but we always prefer to send them to the Veteran Service Officer because they can inform them with to get more benefits. So we basically house the record and secure the record, but we always work through our Veteran Service Officers.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see that in a line of this questioning on page 2, line 16, it does classify this information as private, and then it recognizes some qualified persons that are recognized that the information could be released to, like family members. But my question is more specifically on the new language on lines 13 and 14. This would release data from the forms DD-214 and 215 to another government entity. That seems awfully broad. That could be anything from a school district up to, at least for state purposes, anything up to state government. Does it have to be written so broad? Is there kind of a limited focus of where these documents go? The way I read this, the Department of Natural Resources could request a copy of a DD-214 for some purpose. Is there a need to have it written so broadly?
Mr. Chair and Senator Loomer, we felt actually that this clarified the language to transfer it from one government entity to another. This is a private database which only the VSO officers can search through. So it will only be requested from one veteran service officer from one county to another. There'll be no other access to it. County recorders do not have access to that index. It's only for the veteran service officers. And so that language is only distributed from one VSO to the next VSO in requesting it. It's also requested more in a identifiable nature so that they will know that it is a VSO, and I think generally throughout the state the VSOs know each other and the counties that they work in too. This language was created. We worked with the Minnesota VA and questioned and asked them how we could clarify this language to bring it to this exchange.
Mr. Chair, I guess in light of the answer, knowing that a VSO or Veterans Service Officer is kind of a gatekeeper on who would gain access on behalf of perhaps a request from another government entity. Is that what this bill is really doing?
Ms. Rookie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Loomer, yes, it is.
And, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
I'm assuming, but I haven't seen it here. You know, we do know that this information is classified as private data. And does that private data classification follow whatever agency, department, or government entity would ultimately get that information? Do they have to treat that in the same manner as private?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Loomer.
Yes,
it is private all the way through.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Is there a motion?
I'll move it.
Senator Goodwin moves at Senate file number 338. It's recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Saxo. All right, on to Senate file 2. Well, let's see here. Senator Eakin in the room. I know you're not a member of the committee. If you're not here. Okay, we'll go on to Senator Sharon then. Senate file 253.
I don't know yet.
Interstate Medical Licensure Compact.
Did you read this?
That's interesting, yes. Soda Medical supports it.
Good afternoon.
Senator Schoen.
Senator Latz and members of the committee, I'm here to present Senate File 253, which is the Interstate Medical Compact Bill. With me, I have Ruth Martinez, who is the Executive Director for the Board of Medical Practice, and Eric Dick, who is the Manager of State Legislative Affairs at the Minnesota Medical Association. They are here to answer any questions that you may have that I cannot answer. I would like to give you, if it's okay with you, Chair Latz, just an overview of what the objective of this bill is, what it does do, and I don't know that you have a list of all of the supporters for this bill, but there is a significant number of groups and organizations in the state that have been working for a long time to try to find a way to expedite the licensing process for physicians in order to assist them to practice medicine in other states. As you know, medical practice is and all of the issues related to the practice of medicine is focused on where the patient lives. So all issues and concerns that the patient has about the quality of their care are addressed in the state in which the patient resides. So that creates a scenario in which a physician needs to have multiple licenses in order to practice and follow through with patients that they have in other states. We know with the onset of telehealth and telecommunications that the capacity of the medical community to serve persons across traditional geographic boundaries has changed. And so in the process of that change, the need to be able to be appropriately licensed in the state where the patient resides is even more important. So what this compact does is establish a process to expedite, not to replace, but to expedite. Isn't that an interesting buzz?
It just makes for cracks in the ceiling.
I am too. It's the
I'll
one.
Let you know if anything happens.
I've heard lots of buzzes here, but that's the one that makes me uncertain. Anyway, this is about an expedited license. It doesn't replace. This is important. I want you to understand that. No physician is required to participate in this compact. This is an expedited license that a physician can choose to participate in. And what it does for that physician is requires them to go through the process of credentialing, reviewing the past licensing and certification processes for legitimacy, the review that goes on for background checks, all that goes into determining whether or not a state will issue a license to a physician. That occurs in absolutely every state. And under current law, what happens is that a physician must apply for a license and go through that process in each state in which they hold a license. That process is not removed. That continues to be in place. And a physician can continue to use that traditional method for gaining licenses if that's what that physician chooses. But this offers an alternative, another option for a physician, and that is to get an expedited license. And we can participate in that for our physicians if we pass this legislation that develops a compact of states who agree to the process of expedited licenses. And essentially what the members of the compact agree to, and member states, is that if I'm a physician in Minnesota and I go through the process of having all the background checks and all of my credentials checked, and I'm licensed in the state of Minnesota, but I seek a license in another state that's a member of the compact, that other state will accept the background check and the review of my credentials that was done by my original state. And that's essentially what this bill does and allows for. In order to be eligible for an expedited license, my state has to be a member of this compact. If we don't become a member of the compact, a physician continues to go through the traditional response of having every state and having me pay for all of this review process in every state. So that's essentially what the bill does. What it does not do is change the Medical Practice Act. What it does not do is require a physician to participate in it. It doesn't do anything to take away a state's authority over how the practice of medicine occurs in the member state. All of those powers and authorities of the state are retained in this bill. Let me see if there's anything else. Withdrawal from the compact is easy. It simply requires that the legislature, if they want to withdraw from this compact, which would probably be recommended to us by the profession in the future, they only need to repeal this authorizing authority. The compact is not organized at this time. We are one of several states that are pursuing the authority to participate in the compact. There will need to be at least 7 states agreeing to this legislation before the compact actually begins to function. So if we pass this legislation, it doesn't really get implemented until 7 states have agreed to the elements of this bill. Let me see. I think that the other parts of the bill refer to what happens in terms of a disciplinary process, if there's disciplinary actions taken in. Remember, I said the patient is where the care is given, and where if there is a complaint about the physician's care, it's taken through the process of that state's disciplinary board or medical practices board. But this allows for the interchange of that information between states. I think that really gives the highlights, don't you think, of the bill? And I'd like to offer to you the time to ask specific questions about the bill as it relates to your interest in this committee. And I have these testifiers here to answer those questions.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Members, you have in your committee file a memorandum from counsel that identifies the provisions in the bill that specifically are involved in the Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction. You'll see it's actually a...
I can go through those, Senator Latz, if you'd like me to.
I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
We can ask questions as they arise.
The first statement is that it enacts the Medical Licensure Compact. It's an interstate compact, and under which the member states develop a streamlined process allowing physicians to become licensed in multiple states.
Senator Sharon, do you have the memorandum in front of you so we can just focus on...
Is that
the,
this?
Okay. Okay, very good.
I'll start with paragraph K, the definition of physician. It provides a definition for a physician as it relates to your capacity as a physician to be a member of the compact. It describes that you can't be convicted of an offense, you cannot be under active investigation, etc. It defines offense as a felony. There are eligibility requirements that require that the physician, this is Article 3 eligibility, in order to be eligible to get an expedited license, the individual has to meet requirements.
Senator Limmer, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on eligibility, Senator Sharon, is there a process where uniformity of licensure is assured? I'm unfamiliar with how one qualifies to become a doctor in a medical field. Are some states different than others in how they approve a doctor for full licensure? And how do we know there's a uniformity between other states with our doctors or vice versa?
I think I'll let somebody from the board answer that. I think I know the answer, but I want to make sure that we have the accurate answer to that question. So I think Ruth Martinez, the executive director from the Board of Medical Practice, can answer that best.
So, and members, we'll have Ms. Martin answer the question, and I know some of these questions may come up. I'm going to try to ask the committee to focus on the questions that are within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. So if you can answer this question, then we'll
be Chair, focused. Is my question unrelated or related to the
Council is informing me that maybe a little bit beyond that. No? So, I mean, we have a moment. Let's get the answer to the question, but then we'll try to think about that as we're asking our questions, too.
Mr. Chair, the only reason I asked the question was if there's an enforcement what are we enforcing and what definition of doctor would we enforce? And so I think that just is...
The agile mind of Senator Limmer links it to our jurisdiction.
Could you say agile one more time into the microphone?
Ms. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, thank you. The licensing requirements, as you've suggested, do vary state by state. I think Senator Sharon has pointed out that this particular compact holds minimum requirements to a very high standard, and we still retain all of our authority as a state to take disciplinary actions against physicians who obtain a license through Minnesota. So even within the compact, we must issue the license, and we retain all authority to take action under that license. Does that answer your question, Senator?
I think so.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Sharon.
I lost my way here.
Article 5.
So Article 5 requires a member of the board within the state selected as the principal license for a physician to perform all of that background check of an applicant, fingerprints, other kind of data from the for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This is the background check. That is what is accepted and not repeated in other states. Under renewal and continued preparation, it provides that a physician who seeks to renew an expedited license be granted by a member state must never have been convicted of an offense, which is defined in Article 2. Under Article 8, member boards must report disciplinary or investigatory information deemed necessary by rule of the Interstate Compact. Boards may report non-public complaint or disciplinary or investigatory information to the commission. And they must share about a physician upon request with another member of the compact. The information is confidential, filed under seal, and is used only for the investigatory or disciplinary purposes. Joint investigations, the provisions are included, authorizing the sharing of various materials if there's a joint or individual investigation initiated under the compact. Any subpoena that's issued under a member state is enforceable in other member states. Disciplinary actions, in Article 10, Paragraph D, there are provisions that if disciplinary action, other than a licensing being revoked, surrendered, or relinquished, is taken against a physician by a member board, any other board may deem the action conclusive, can accept it as to matter of law and fact decided. Under Article 11, which is the, did you want to say something more about that? Under Interstate Medical License Compact Commission, it has language there about public notice of meetings. The circumstances under which the meetings may be closed are specified. Language there requires under paragraph J that the commission make its information and official records available to the public, to the extent that it's not otherwise designated in the compact or by its rules as closed or private. Under Article 14, paragraph D provides that officers and employees of the commission are immune from liability. It also has immunity provisions and liability limitations for the executive director under paragraphs E. Paragraph F contains language related to the duty to defend. Paragraph G contains language that holds harmless provisions for representatives or employees in cases where a judgment, including attorney fees, is not covered by the involved state. So it protects other members of the compact from those financial obligations. Let's see what else is in here. Article 16 requires the courts to take judicial notice of the compact rules. Article 17 is the enforcement of the interstate compact. It allows by majority vote of the compact, which membership, by the way, is made up of two members from each state. I'm going to ask Ms. Martinez to say what the membership exactly is.
Ms. Martin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The membership would be two appointed members from each board. It could be either a physician or a public board member or an executive director or high-ranking administrative person within a board.
Article 8.
Ms. Martin, so each state's board of medical practice would then have two designated representatives on the Interstate Compact Commission?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, yes. Each participating state has two commissioners.
Article 18 relates to default procedures. A state that's been found by the commission to be in default may appeal the action of the commission to the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, or in the Federal District Court where the commission has its principal offices. And then Article 19 is language related to dispute resolution.
So on the dispute resolution provision, does it require a binding dispute resolution, like binding arbitration, to address this, or is the court still an option?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Ms. Martin.
The dispute resolution really authorizes the Interstate Commission to promulgate rules for developing both mediation and binding dispute resolution. I'm not sure that I can answer the question as to whether I feel like there is language in here as far as court processes, and if you maybe in a moment I can find that and be more helpful.
It's really vague language.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the language in Article 19 under dispute resolution. So the Interstate Commission shall promulgate rules providing for both mediation and binding dispute resolution as appropriate. But as appropriate isn't defined. So it sounds like the commission will decide for itself sometime down the road whether and how to mandate binding arbitration. Is that the way you read it?
That is what we read. We are authorizing the compact that's made up of members of two Board of Medical Practice members from each state to promulgate some rules for how it operates,
but
including
let's
this.
Let's say the Minnesota members vote no, but the rest of the members, the majority, vote to require binding arbitration and to prohibit a member state from going to court in connection with a dispute within the Interstate Compact.
Yes, the answer would be that would be the act, that would be the rule or the operations of the compact, even if Minnesota's two delegates voted against that.
And do you know, is this sort of a standard procedural approach to dispute resolution among interstate compacts, or is this kind of unusual for this particular one?
Mr. Chair and members, Eric Dick with the Minnesota Medical Association. I don't believe I have an answer for you, Mr. Chair. Minnesota, of course, is a member of 26 different compacts dating back to 1947 and more recently. I can't say that I've spent any time with the dispute resolution. One point that I'd reiterate, though, is that, as Senator Sheeran suggested, the compact is not established until seven states act upon it. Should Minnesota be one of those states, it will be involved in the initial rulemaking process, so a seat at the table, so to speak.
Senator Lemmer.
Mr. Chairman, in the bill, I quickly read it, or tried to read it all, but we're granting a number of authorities to the Interstate Commission through the process of rulemaking, as opposed to following any existing law that might be established by a member state. What happens if there is a rule that's contrary to a state law? In sharing information, there's information about databases being formed or licensure enforcement. If a state existing state law is written, but the Interstate Commission would write a different rule, is that Are we basically giving them, giving the authority over to them that they will govern the whatever the decision would be by their own rulemaking authority in complete ignorance of a state statute?
This compact does not supersede the Medical Practices Act or any of the elements of the Medical Practices Act for the physician who is licensed in the state or the physician who is licensed as a result of a license that they receive through the compact. The state's laws are all the superior law as it applies to the care of the patient in that state.
Okay.
The rules that are going to be promulgated are more about how the compact itself operates. And there will be two members from each state who get to participate in that. The earlier you get in, the more influence you'll have over the developing the operations of the compact. But the out is, if anything begins to go in a way that is unacceptable to the Minnesota Medical Association and the practice of medicine that they oversee, they can remove themselves from the compact. There's always that option.
Senator Chernus, as I understand it, the state would have to pass a law repealing the authorization
to repeal
to
this.
The compact
yes.
to accomplish that end.
Yes.
Senator Limmer.
Perhaps this is just a little too much for me to swallow in one bite, but take, for example, Article 8, Coordinated Information System. It gives Interstate Commission the ability to establish a database. Down on line 26, page 6, 26, or actually 25, says all information provided to the commission or distributed by member boards shall be confidential, and then they make an added reference and used only for investigatory or disciplinary purposes. I would imagine that's pretty close to how Minnesota would classify investigative data. We normally would consider it confidential, meaning that even the doctor involved would not have access to any knowledge of an investigation going on, even if he requested it. But if in Minnesota someone came up and said, are you conducting any type of investigation on me? I can't remember for sure if Minnesota would have to grant that information, and would that be uniform throughout the entire Interstate Commission, or would it only be recognizing Minnesota's reference to that definition of confidential? I'm suggesting that maybe the definition of confidential is not in this statute for this purpose.
Ms. Martinez.
Ms. Martin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Limmer, thanks for your question. The Minnesota Data Practices Act does currently classify the board's investigative data as confidential, and as you've suggested, a licensee would not have access to that data. However, under Chapter 214, under the board's investigative process, we do need to notify a licensee that he or she may be under investigation. So while they may be aware of an investigation, they may not have access to the board's investigative data during the active pending investigation.
Well, Mr. Chair, on page 7, line 1, it says member boards may share any investigative data. So other boards and other states could gain access to what is considered confidential under investigative litigation or compliance materials. And so for the purposes of enforcement, if another state had access, improper access, or used that information, shared it with someone else beyond the limitations of what Minnesota law is, would they be subject to our enforcement? And if that's the case, how would you enforce something in another state?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Martin.
Senator Limmer, the Board of Medical Practice already has statutory authority to share its confidential and private data with other states under Chapter 214. And so I don't believe that there is anything in the language of this compact that changes our authority to share data or the obligations of the receiving state to protect that data as it is classified here in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, one other question. This seems like it's a uniform law type of statute, and I was just wondering, has this been vetted in the uniform law people that make these things so that there's a common reference of statute between states? I see that Judge Davies is in the audience, but I don't know if the uniform law delegates that we have chosen to represent Minnesota.
This is not a product of the Uniform Law Commission. It's not related to that in any way.
Is it something, Mr. Chairman, that should be considered by the Uniform Law Conference that they have from year to year?
Suppose we can suggest it through one of our emissaries that the Uniform Law Commission consider interstate expedited medical licensing.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just asking if this has been vetted anywhere.
Where did this come from? Tell us that. Who proposed this? Did a bunch of state boards of medical practice get together and said we got to figure out a way to allow doctors to get expedited licensure in other states since they're practicing telemedicine while living here in Minnesota but treating someone at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona?
Mr. Chair, I think I can answer that question. This really began as a conversation at the Federation of State Medical Boards, and it was really in response to some significant conversation at the national level to nationalize licensure, particularly around telemedical practice. And there was great concern on the part of many states about national licensure, and so states came together with the Federation facilitating that process to develop and introduce interstate medical licensure compact for the purposes of expediting licensure across state lines and to retain the sovereignty of states to both issue and act against licenses involving care against patients within those individual states.
So, for example, it sounds like there's kind of a high bar set here, as in no convictions for felonies or gross misdemeanors or crimes of moral turpitude. But if a state, you know, had a somewhat lower standard on their own, if you didn't qualify it for the expedited licensure through here, you could still go and separately apply in that individual state through their own process. And maybe you'd qualify because they have some exceptions available for certain kinds of convictions or something. Is that kind of the idea here? Is that kind of a high bar across the standard? Mr. Dick?
Mr. Chair and members, that's exactly the case. The bill establishes a very high standard. Minnesota operates under a very high standard to begin with, but that's exactly the case. Were a Minnesota physician not eligible, they could pursue the conventional route of licensure in each individual state and not through the Compact Commission.
So are we going to end up with applicants for licensure from out of state to be able to practice here that are somehow less qualified than what our current in-state Minnesota process requires for licensure?
Absolutely not. Go ahead. No. Mr. Chair, absolutely not. The bar that we hold here in Minnesota will always be met. The bar in the compact is very high, and I expect it will remain high. Minnesota has high licensure standards, and I do not see in any way that this would diminish the credentialing process here in Minnesota.
May I add to that? Remember, in order to practice here, they still have to have a license to practice here, and they have to meet the requirements of practice here in the state of Minnesota. That doesn't change. None of that changes. What changes is that it becomes expedited. It's easier because they do not have to go through the process of background check, review of credentials, making certain that all the components that are necessary for licensing are met in each of the states. Right now, if I want to practice in Wisconsin or Iowa or Chicago, I have to go through this process each time in each state. That's what's being expedited. Nothing changes in terms of what's expected in terms of the practice of medicine in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, is there opposition to this?
Well, you have received a communication from, this is the only opposition that we've heard. I wish I had my list of supporters in front of me.
Members, there is a list of supporters in your packet on a letterhead from the Minnesota Medical Association.
The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons has sent a communication to you in opposition to this Senate file. But, you know, I could go through and help you understand how the assumptions in this are not connected to what's in the Interstate Compact Bill. For example, if you are reading through the letter from AAPS, it says, whereas interstate medical licensure will supersede the state's authority, the language of this bill, Minnesota retains complete control over the practice of medicine, as opposed to what is suggested in this whereas. And then their next whereas, I think, is that they will likely implement changes to our state's Medical Practice Act. But nothing in this bill does change the Medical Practice Act. In fact, the bill states clearly that state medical boards that participate in the compact retain jurisdiction to improve an adverse action against a license to practice medicine, and that issues to a physician through the procedures in the compact. So another is that, let's see, the changes, whereas the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact definition of a physician is at variance with all other states of medical state boards, I'm not sure what that means. The definition of physician in the bill is different, but that doesn't stop a person from having a license in another state based on the definition of the practice. The definition is different here because we're raising the bar as to who can participate in it. It's an expedited process, so we want to make sure that the bar is very high. So of the physicians, about 80% of the physicians will meet this criteria. 10% will not, and not be able to, without meeting the criteria, be eligible for an expedited license. So that is the opposition that you have in front of you in this handout, but the assumptions that are in those whereases are inaccurate in relationship to the language in the bill.
Just before we go on, members, we did receive a note from the author of Senate File 107 that they do not wish to proceed with the hearing on that bill today in Judiciary Committee. So we're going to remove that from the agenda. If there's anyone here in the audience that was here for Senate File 107, it is not necessary for you to stick around for that bill. You're certainly welcome to stay and listen to the other scintillating conversation. Back to this Senate file, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, can you tell me again then what this is supposed to take care of? What's the need out there, or what does this resolve that can't be done already?
Senator Sharon.
A physician can get a license to practice medicine in another state. In order to do that, the physician applies and goes through a process for each state for licensing that physician. So that remains the same. That doesn't go away. A physician can use that process if they want to. What this does for the physician is allow an expedited, meaning it speeds up the process for them, because if our state's physicians are a member of this compact, then they can apply for a license in any state. They don't get a license to practice in every state that's in the compact. They only get a license for the state in which they've asked for a license. And what they get is, as a part of the membership, is the ability to have the new state that they're seeking the license in accept the state of Minnesota's, in this case, if it's a Minnesota physician's, workup of that person's license to make sure it's legitimate and that it meets all of the requirements for the practice of medicine. If a person is from another state that's in the compact, let's say it's who else is looking to be in this? I think there are like 10 states that are seeking this legislation. One of those other states that's their home state. That's where their license to practice wants to practice in Minnesota. Then they can apply to practice in Minnesota, but it's expedited because Minnesota will accept that other state's background check on that. They will accept that that state has affirmed that that physician meets all the requirements for the practice of medicine.
Senator Hall. Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, then, how does the telemedical need get into this? Is the idea that you cannot do telemedical procedures in another state unless you're licensed in that state from this state?
Yes, that's true under both expedited and traditional. The care of the patient has to be done by a medical provider who is licensed in the state in which the patient resides. So if you live in Wisconsin and your physician is in Minneapolis, your physician in Minneapolis must apply for and get a Wisconsin medical license in order to care for you over the telephone or through telecommunications.
So Madam
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, it's not then where they reside, but it's what license they would hold. They would hold a compact license. If he resides in Wisconsin and wants to do some work in telemedical, he can't do that unless he has what?
Well, remember, it's got to be where his patient is.
Yep.
So if he lives in, and if his primary residence and primary license is in a state other than where the patient lives, then he must have a license in the state where the patient lives.
Or where the patient is located for purposes
or resides. Of it's their resides.
Where they,
no,
as
not
they
where
live there?
Where they reside.
Wait, so
no.
Let me clarify. If I'm a Connecticut resident, but I'm down in Phoenix getting treatment, but I want the doctor from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota to treat
it's
me
where
while
he's getting
I'm
treatment.
In Arizona.
It's where he's getting treatment.
It's where he's getting treatment.
Yes.
Okay. No matter that he actually resides in Connecticut.
Yes.
Okay.
It's where the patient is, I guess would be a better way of saying it.
Okay. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, these things can all be done now. It's just a slower process. Is what I'm hearing. And so tell me, is this going to help physicians, that there are fewer physicians that need to be able to do this, or will this take cases away from physicians in our state because somebody else from another state is going to be now doing procedures in our state, and so our physicians won't be used as much? Have we thought through that aspect at all?
Senator Sharon.
You know, I think that because this can occur already, that dynamic, whatever that is already in place. This doesn't change or impact the capacity of a physician to practice in another state under just simply applying and meeting the background check requirements. So that dynamic is still in place. This simply is expediting the capacity of the physician to get a license so that they can serve. So physicians in any of our major clinics who want to consult over the internet for very specialized kind of consultation can do that with a person that's receiving treatment in another part of the state, another state.
Last question.
Senator Hall, I wasn't really being facetious when I mentioned Mayo either. The Mayo Clinic has facilities in Arizona, and I think they have in Florida, if I remember correctly, as well. So their physicians who want to treat patients who are in Arizona or Florida would have to be licensed in Arizona or Florida to do that, and this would actually be more efficient for them to get that license. More efficiency, less cost. It'll reduce the cost of health care, Senator Hall.
Ooh, now you're talking. Last question,
last
if
question,
I may,
Senator.
Mr. Chair. I have a relative of mine that is a doctor out of Colorado, and he is now practicing temporarily in Minnesota. I assume he's had to get a license to do that in Fairmont. And is he somehow grandfathered in, or will he then have to go through the same process?
Senator Sharon.
He will have to meet the criteria that's described in this bill and then apply for this expedited license.
Wait, even if he's but already licensed in Minnesota?
Yes.
So he'll have to go back through an expedited process?
He doesn't have to. He doesn't have to. He has a license to practice here. That will be grandfathered in. He can continue. Maybe I'm not making myself clear. In order to get an expedited license, he has to apply for it. But because he already has a license to practice in Minnesota under the traditional method, that's still all of that traditional system remains in place.
Okay.
But if he wants an expedited license to practice in another state, then he'd have to. He wouldn't have to, but he could try to accomplish that through the expedited process.
So Senator
Thank you.
Hall's itinerant doctor relative will find this attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Senator
Possibly.
Newman, did you have your hand up earlier?
No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon has more than adequately answered all the questions I have.
Okay. Any other questions?
Fabulous.
Seeing none. Senator Sharon, do you have a motion?
Yes. Does this go to the floor? We've been through.
It goes to finance.
Goes to finance.
Health and
okay.
Human Services Division of Finance.
Senator, my motion is that Senate File 253 pass and be referred to finance.
Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 253 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon. We have the Minnesota Trust Code up, Senate File 578. Is Senator Cohen in the room? Senator Cohen is on his way.
Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman.
Can you entertain us while we're waiting for Senator Cohen?
I see that Senator Cohen isn't in the room, but Senator Newman is here. Maybe he could talk about the Minnesota Trust Code enactment that he has endorsed.
He's
by
an author.
As a co-author.
Yeah.
Off the top of his head. Start on page 33, will you please?
Mr. Chairman, I would really, I think it would be a good idea if we wait for Senator Cohen. I really do.
Sure, words were never spoken.
Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Senator. Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate to ask Senator Cohen maybe some background history to this bill?
No. Senator Cohen?
No.
Depends how long you want to stay here.
So. Yeah. Well said.
Mr. Chairman, is there any reference to the Minnesota Trust Code in the Federalist Papers? I was just wondering.
Probably something about trust.
Generally. The audience doesn't know what we're talking about.
No, that's.
Are we going to do 569?
Oh, sure. Say, while we're waiting, I'll give the members and those who not members of the committee but still care about what we do some heads up about what's coming ahead of us. We will be, remember, the committee deadline is the end of March, March 27th. And so we have a lot of bills in the committee, and we're going to have to pass a lot of bills on re-referral. So you should plan on meeting every Friday in March.
Yeah, I know.
All right, we've done this before, so it's not a surprise, I suppose. But we're going to meet on March 6th at 10 a.m., not 9 as previously posted, and probably go until around 1 on that day. And we just have one bill scheduled for that day at this time. But then the other Fridays, you should expect to be here, including on deadline days, so that we can get as many of our colleagues' bills coming from other committees through. And again, we're going to ask members to focus specifically on the provisions in those bills that have invoked the Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction and not get too far afield on the other parts of the bill. And our next meeting after today is going to be on Thursday, and we will have a number of interesting bills to consider, as we always do. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, on the other Fridays, what time will we be starting?
Should anticipate 9 o'clock.
Oh.
Well, after 11? I'm sorry. Taxes might have this room until 11. So we can't dispossess the tax committee. 11 o'clock, until whatever time we need to go to get the bills done for that day.
Is there another meeting
Mr.
room
Chairman.
We can get and start earlier?
I hear the front steps of the Capitol are
I mean, it may be this room, but there may be others that might be available.
We will look for some, but there are very limited rooms available in the Capitol now, unfortunately.
Mr. Chairman.
We could convene at the Kelly Inn, I suppose, in the bar.
We'd never if,
since there are a few lawyers on the committee here, we could have a bar convention.
If I may, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Newman, a lawyer.
To the best of your ability, I would ask that you search for a room so that we can start at 9 o'clock on Friday and try to be done around noon. And I say that only very selfishly. It's nice to go home on the weekends. And I know that we have to do that. But if we are going to start at, say, 11 o'clock in the morning, that isn't going to put me, for instance, home until that evening. And I really would appreciate it if we could start and do this in the morning. I would sincerely appreciate it.
Senator Newman, we will do our very best to find another room. But given the history of deadlines around here and the number of bills we see on re-referral, we've had to go through 8, 9, 10-hour days on deadline Fridays.
Yeah.
I'm really trying to avoid doing evenings during the week.
Sure, and I understand.
And I suppose some might prefer evenings during the week and to be out earlier on Friday, but that makes for long days too.
Would there be a possibility any rooms be available at SOB? Do you have any idea?
We'll take a look into the state office building as well. Okay. We'll see if we can find something. If we can, we'll start earlier on Fridays.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Cohen. Minnesota Trust Code.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's so good to be back home. It's like a class reunion for me to come back to the Judiciary Committee. And I can tell you I still miss it.
From one of our most distinguished alumni.
Except when I listen to people like Senator Newman talk about the scheduling. Mr. Chairman, members, we have in front of us Senate file 578. There's an amendment, I believe, prepared by counsel. I'd like to have offered as an author's amendment as that's being distributed. I'll indicate that the amendment is three technical changes and a slightly more substantive change. Maybe just offer a little bit of background. This is a several-year project through the State Bar Association Special Commission on trusts. Chris Hunt, who's a partner at the Frederickson firm to my right, is chairman of the commission. And let me count around the table. I see one, two, three. Well, yeah, Senator Newman. So three lawyers. And as we can all tell the rest of you, very rarely in the legislature do you find somebody who has an expertise in trust or probate law. And so we tend to depend heavily on the work of the Bar Association to work through these issues, present them to us. Obviously, they got to find one of us novice lawyers as the person to author the bill. So this year, that's myself. along with, I believe, Senator Newman and Mr. Chairman yourself. So again, as I mentioned, this has been a several-year project on the part of the Special Commission to provide this recodification of the trust code. And it's been worked through, Mr. Hunt can indicate, I believe it's an 18-member commission that has worked on this and have done a very substantive job. I've had the chance to meet a couple of times with a larger group of the attorneys working on this. But as I think all of us know from our years here, that these kinds of issues tend not to fall within the purview of those of us who are actually the legislators. So if I could have that amendment distributed, if that would be okay. This is the first committee and the only committee.
Yes, members, the A15-70 amendment is in your packet. It is an author's amendment. Okay. Senator Newman?
I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman moves the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Cohen.
And Mr. Chairman, could I get a copy of the amendment?
No.
Not it's been adopted. So I'm going to say that I don't think I have one amendment. No, I guess I do have the amendment. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, members, if I could ask Mr. Hunt to offer some testimony as to what they've been doing, what the intent is, and what's encompassed in the legislation.
Mr. Hunt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Latz and senators. You have before you the work of a bar committee that's been in the works since June of 2010. The Uniform Trust Code was first adopted by the Uniform Law Commission in the year 2000 and was studied in Minnesota for parts of it from time to time until 2010 when the Bar Association assembled a committee of people who practice in trust and estate law and asked us to take a serious look at this legislation that now has been adopted in 30 states and the District of Columbia. This 4.5-year study was done by a committee of 18 lawyers that practice in trusts and estates, and there are representatives from other parts of the state as well as the metropolitan area. We had representatives of the court, representatives from the corporate trust world, members of large firms and small firms. So we got a very broad array of opinions on what should be done. There also were four lawyers who were brought in with litigation specialties so that the court proceedings parts of this legislation could be looked at from their perspective as well. So that was done. Then we also worked in tandem with the Uniform Law Commissioners, specifically Robert Stein from the University of Minnesota, who is one of the Uniform Law Commissioners in Minnesota. We worked quite often with him to make sure that we were working in line with what his committee was interested in doing. The reasons for the legislation largely are that Minnesota has had a trust law since 1989 that has had a few amendments, but not very many. But the trust law in the country has changed remarkably in that 25-year period. It has certainly become more nationalized, and we have people in the Twin Cities today and throughout Minnesota from other parts of the country, often large organizations that are either large banks or brokerage firms that offer trust services. And we want Minnesota to remain competitive with all the other states that also are trying to attract that same business. Specifically, we have a state just to our west, South Dakota, who has become kind of a trust mecca. And so parts of our bill are in response to what's happening in South Dakota, although we have not become as liberal as they have on how trusts are administered. The new law before us, I think, will answer many of the questions that our current law simply doesn't resolve. I'm going to provide you just a few of the highlights. Among one of the benefits is that we have 20 new definitions that help trust practitioners and the courts in interpreting trust instruments. Currently, we don't have any definitions in the trust code, so courts and practitioners need to rely on those definitions in the probate court or as developed in case law. We've also vastly expanded the use of non-judicial settlement agreements, which we see as a real positive given the caseloads that our courts in this state have in the probate and trust area. One of the things I think we've done is create more flexibility in court proceedings by having a dual track. The Uniform Trust Code uses in personam jurisdiction as the basis of its jurisdiction for court proceedings, but Minnesota has used in rem proceeding for 150 years. And we thought if we were to adopt the in personam approach and and leave in rem behind us, that would not be a benefit to our courts and to our practitioners. So we have given people a choice between those methods. And so those people who feel that an in personam proceeding, which is one basically where you start it like a lawsuit, where you serve a party, as opposed to publishing notice in a newspaper, that's an in rem proceeding. So I think that's a vast improvement helping the courts. We've also expanded the situations where parties can represent other parties in a proceeding. The most common example would be where a parent can represent the interests of a child in a court proceeding where we have a minor child involved or a disabled person. We've also added some flexibility in modifying or terminating trusts where through the change of events or the changes in laws, trusts that were drafted many years ago don't work as efficiently. So it gives the parties the ability to bring those into a modern understanding of how to administer the trust. One of the things we've done is we've preserved Minnesota's historically strong spendthrift law. We have really not made any changes to that. It's a well-developed law in Minnesota protecting parties. We've also clarified that the capacity to make a revocable trust now will be the same as it is for a will. And I think many of us would know that revocable trust arrangements are being used much more commonly now and are often used as substitutes for wills. So we felt that the standard for making one should be the same. We've also changed the law, or this bill would change the law, so that instead of requiring trustees to act by unanimous decision, they can act by majority decision. But there are also protections built into the statute so that if someone disagreed with the decision of the majority, they can note that in writing to protect their own interests. But we think this, again, is in keeping with the modern trend in trust law. This is not to say, however, that the party creating a trust couldn't require unanimous action by a trustee. They simply would have to put that in their trust document. So this change is a default rule. We've also allowed for a new concept in Minnesota called a directed trust. And with the sophistication, increasing sophistication of investments and other kinds of decisions that trustees are required to make, we now allow a trustee to say, you can rely on the advice that you get from parties giving you information about investments or about distribution decisions and so forth. And if the trustee follows those directions, then they have protections. We've also introduced a new concept called trust decanting. And this sounds like it'd be something having to do with wine, but it doesn't. It's a way in which trustees can modify trusts that, because of changes of circumstances or changes in law, have grown out of date, and the trustee has the ability to make certain modifications if they meet the standards of decanting. So these are a few of the highlights. I'd be happy to address any questions that the committee may have. I believe you were provided a little summary of the bill, and some of these points I've just made are in that summary, but I'd be happy to address other points.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Are there any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Hunt? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions of Mr. Hunt or Senator Cohen. I would only indicate parenthetically that when I signed on as a co-author, I did look through the bill. I don't claim to have read it in great detail, but I did read it with an eye as to anything that was going to jump out at me as to creating a problem or raising a situation where a trustee or a beneficiary of a trust or the trustor would not be granted due process. That's really kind of where I was looking at it. And I didn't see anything in there of that nature. So with my somewhat limited understanding of trust law, I do support the bill and would urge the rest of the members of the committee to do so also.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Cohen.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, just kind of a parenthetical comment. I actually mentioned this to Mr. Hunt as we came downstairs that, in the metro area, those of us who do practice law tend to specialize in certain areas. And the nice thing about having Senator Newman as a member of not just the committee but the legislature, is as somebody who comes from outside the Twin Cities and possibly in the course of your practice was forced to take a broader look than some of the rest of us would look at, offers an advantage to to the rest of the attorneys and legislature in that respect, because just given the annual sessions and the distances, it's not like the old days, Mr. Chairman, your father was serving, when you'd have all sorts of attorneys from, you know, throughout the state. And unfortunately, that's to some extent, that's disappeared.
Well, we do offer law school for legislators every 2 years over at William Mitchell. Doesn't quite make up for it. All right, any other further questions, discussion on Senate File 578? Senator Newman, would you like to move the bill?
I would indeed, Mr. Chairman. Does it go to the floor?
Oh, let's see here. Yes, it goes to the floor. Senator Newman moves that Senate File number 578 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Cohen, Mr. Hunt, brilliant work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, I got to defend Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman on the Senate floor, because I won't have Mr. Hunt there with me.
We'll get it done.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, that concludes our work for today. We will see you on Thursday. We are adjourned.